Time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy. Now in our 16th year, right here in Residence 104.4. Hi, Stacy.
16th year?
Oh, did I get it wrong? I meant 26 years. That's right. 26 years every Saturday, Residence FM 104.4. It's a glorious sunny day here in Florida.
Well, you out there in London may be very confused. This is Residence 104.4 FM in London. Max Kaiser is indeed ready to be sent to an old folks' home in Florida, as you can tell. But the sunshine and the vitamin D is certainly rejuvenating you, Max Kaiser.
Yeah.
So we've had a very big week, mm-hmm. end to the week, and yeah. Detroit has declared Chapter 9 bankruptcy, uh-huh. the biggest municipal bankruptcy in American history. It's they owe, I guess, there's about $18 to $20 billion of debt, depending on how you want to scam it.
Yeah, a lot of debt. Well, you know, this was coming for a long time, and it's part of this process where the pensions of the workers... the banks don't want to pay them anymore because they want to keep that money for themselves. So they throw the city under the bus and they default on all the pensions. And it's just a growing. It's in the UK. It's in the US. It's in Greece. It's in Italy. It's around the world. Dictators don't like to share their money with anybody other than their immediate circle of concubines. Sycophants and compliant media types.
Well, the Detroit situation is pretty spectacular. I'm still trying to get to grips with it, but what it looks like is, yes, basically the pension fund, the municipal workers' pension fund, and then there's the firemen and policemen pension fund. And remarkably, they were both in surplus in 2002. Then in 2005, the funding ratios had collapsed. So they went to Wall Street. And mm-hmm. Wall Street issued some new bonds, which cost tens of millions of dollars. And then the following year, inexplicably, they refinanced those for even more tens of millions of dollars of bonds from Wall Street. And these ones came attached with some interest rate swaps, which ended up costing tens of millions of dollars more than they otherwise would. Because, of course, we know what happened is the financial collapse and interest rates crashed rather than go up. They were protecting themselves against rising interest rates. Now, so this is Wall Street shenanigans and the market crash, which caused the pension funds to go into slip into being underfunded. But the interesting thing is Rick Snyder, you know, one of these Tea Party superheroes who smashes unions and hates workers. Well, he appointed this interim emergency manager, Bob Orr, I think is his name. And he's also done shenanigans by changing the discount rate at which the pension funds are determined. So he made it look like he could say they're $700 million underfunded, but he's chosen to say they're $3.5 billion underfunded. Mm-hmm. Looking into the future, he's saying things could get worse or this or that. And, you know, he's chosen the worst of the scenarios because only under that, once they're 80% underfunded, once they slip under 80% funded, he can seize control of them. And so that's what they've done.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it goes back to Bismarck in Germany inventing the welfare state and the idea that you could effectively crowdfund a lot of the liabilities of the state for old age medical expenses and retirement expenses by having people contribute to these pools of capital that would be made available when people got ill in their elder years or in retirement. And some have called this a good, quote-unquote, good Ponzi scheme because it kind of has characteristics of a Ponzi scheme. And other states have mimicked the Bismarck approach to the so-called welfare state. You see across Europe. You see it in America with Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid. And it does generate these huge pools of capital, just like Norway has a sovereign wealth fund. And they decided, you know what, state's going to take some off the top. We're going to create a state fund. It's going to call it the Sovereign Wealth Fund, which, by the way, is now almost worth $800 billion. There's almost $1 trillion in cash in the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. But it's a similar concept. The state gets involved in collecting a few nickels here and there to create a safety net, a buffer, you know, just like a bank would have a buffer in its on its balance sheet in case of a bank run or an event of this nature. So what happened is that, now flash forward from Bismarck and through the 20th century and the World War II, and I go take us to 1980, 1983, and the beginning of what's called neoliberal Reagan and Thatcher deregulations and neoliberal economics, the Washington Consensus, so-called. And what you have is a lot of Wall Street people in the city of London who look at these huge pools of capital in these pension accounts, in these retirement accounts, in these state funds and corporate funds, and they start salivating. They start, you know, how can we get our hands on that money? So in the case of corporate America, it launched the leverage buyout period and the corporate raider of the 1980s, and we still have some names left from those days, like Carl Icahn is still active. You know, he's trying to screw up Dell Computer at the moment. And then on the government front, we have the private equity and the private price PPI schemes in this country, PPP schemes. These are all meant to give private enterprise a crack at huge pools of money that have been sitting there. So as you point out, Detroit was in surplus, you know, a decade ago or so. The Wall Street Sharpies say, aha, you know, how do we get our hands on that money? So they sell them some faulty financial products, credit default swaps, that are guaranteed to transfer the wealth to them. It never works the other way. Wall Street's never had a situation where they sell a product to somebody like a state, and suddenly, oh my God, the state has a multi-hundred-billion-dollar windfall. How did that happen? And Wall Street lost. That's never, ever, ever, never happened as far as I know. Or if it has, Wall Street gets bailed out. Like they saw in 2008, like suddenly, oh, things went against them. Their bets started going the other way. Well, I guess we need a bailout from the state. So they're never taking any risk. So they, and Detroit, just like Greece, and they got their books cooked to enter the euro. Same thing with Italy. Just like Anglo-Irish Bank in Ireland, we discover was a huge con game, a scam meant to enrich a few bankers. Detroit's the same thing. But that's the history of it. You have these huge pools of capital. It used to be things like Glass-Steagall was a law that kept Wall Street and Main Street separated, and there was a lot of ways to protect people from the parasitical behavior of Wall Street in the city. And all those checks and balances and walls have been systematically removed, or new laws have been to override the old laws. And the result is what we have here. So Detroit is... I just tweeted that effectively Detroit will become America's Gaza. So you'd have a population of people that are, it's an open air prison. There's going to be a wall between Detroit and the rest of Michigan. It'll be people living in a harsh, harsh ghetto environment. And, it'll be a martial law, you know, kind of a soft martial law will be declared for Detroit within the next 24 months.
Well, of course, these former manufacturing powerhouses. Remember, Detroit was the manufacturing capital of the world at one point, and it was the richest state in the It was the highest per capita income in the 1960s. So this is how far it's fallen. But remember, a lot of people. What you've seen in America is you had Scott Walker in Wisconsin, and now you have Rick Snyder in Michigan. And they've looked at the situation, and the people who support them look at the situation and said, it's the workers. The workers have too much rights, too many rights. Not the bankers, not the tax system that incentivizes corporations to export their jobs and manufacturing. It's not that. It's the workers, the few that remain, that they have too many rights. So it's interesting as well that now this financial war has, you know, it followed classic tactics of first they came for the communists, but I wasn't a communist, so I did nothing. Then they came for the gypsies, but I wasn't a gypsy, so I did nothing. And then they came for the Jews, and so on and so on. Well, Scott Walker and Rick Snyder, of course, they were able to attack the teachers and nurses unions, right? Because those are mostly women. So they got all the men on their side. They did nothing against the police or firemen unions. Those were okay. Those were the good unions. Those guys protect us. They serve us. They provide security, because that's the one thing. Americans are terrified, right? They live in constant fear. So anybody that has a gun or could protect them from the fear out there, the unknown, unquantifiable fear, they support. But now Detroit has come down to these firemen and police unions, and there's a war on for their pension. And this is a remarkable story that I found via Kate Long, who writes for Reuters. She writes Muniland. So she covers the whole municipal bond market. Well, in their filing, the Rick Snyder's filing for bankruptcy, they listed the home addresses of all 2,500 police officers in Detroit, including the head of the anti-gang squad. They have their home addresses listed on the filings. Kate Long says she's never seen anything like this in any municipal bond, municipal bankruptcy ever, and that it's a very aggressive tactic.
Well, they're scapegoating this group. So anytime you have fascism, you have banks and combining forces with the corruption in government, you need a scapegoat. Okay, so they need to present a narrative that there is a bad guy and a good guy here. And they're the good guys, and somebody's got to be the bad guy. Now, America is not divided so much along religious lines. It is divided more against in race, primarily race. So in the case of Detroit, which is 85% black, the subtext here is, you know, it's pretty easy to commit an act of genocide against black population. Nobody in America would say no to that. If you post the addresses for cops on a website and you put a target on their back, you are effectively murdering police. The state is murdering police. So historically, anytime you see the state murdering its own police force and the wholesale theft of assets from a group that's being scapegoated, you know you're in a severely fascist, dysfunctional. As Jimmy Carter said just a few days ago, he said America is not a functioning democracy. He would not classify America as a functioning democracy. This is a former president of the United States. So you can't really argue with that.
Well, that's the subject of our latest Kaiser report on this today's episode, Saturday. It's about all the fear, how profitable fear is. Like it's a very easy emotion to control. You control that, you can definitely just print money, whether it's, you know, if you're a Wall Street banker or part of the military industrial complex, you just scare people. Especially the more unknowable the scary person, the boogeyman is, actually human imagination is so much more powerful than reality. So you make sure you never ever actually capture or put on trial or see the fear, who these people are. So this unknowable fear out there, and you...
It goes back, you know, you go back in 2,000 years, 2,400 years, 2,500 years, you know, and the Greek dramatists who gave us Prometheus Unbound, and Prometheus committed the sin of giving mankind fire to take him away from the fear, because the gods were wielding ultimate power to the poor humans who were in the dark and had no ability to protect themselves from the fear of the dark, of the night. And so Prometheus committed this massive sin of, you know, giving humans fire. And but here, so you see the power here. So American businessmen want to take away American civil rights, human rights, the ability to live a life free of fear. And it goes beyond, I think, you're pointing out there, is that it's just not about taking away the right to assemble, the right to free speech, the right to an attorney, the right to habeas corpus, the right to a fair trial. Though all of those things are being stripped away, that's understood. But they're also going more top, high level. They're taking away freedom from fear. And that, I think that is more or less the definition of an open-air prison. So whether it's Detroit, you know, spreading out its, the wings of this atrocity, this pogrom in America by the state and banks, how far it'll reach. I can't imagine it won't go coast to coast, and you'll have America as the biggest open-air prison in the world.
Well, yet another, you know, study, and there have been dozens of them over the past few, you know, 20 years or so, is another study shows that Americans now live shorter lives than men and women in most of the rest of the developed world, and that gap is growing. And all the studies show that though the U.S. was number one in 1950, just around the time that Detroit had the highest income per capita in the world, in the U.S., that's when the U.S. had the number one longevity. They were the longest living in the world. Why? Obviously, because they were more equal. There was equality. And now they're saying that they've dropped down to 27. They keep on dropping, like huge drops, down the health scales globally, because they reckon that it's not because they eat worse or exercise less, because, you know, as you, if you ever watch Mad Men, you see that people smoked, chain smoked, and drank so much hard alcohol during the day back then, and yet they still lived longer than relative to the rest of the world. Now they're saying that they've determined that it's inequality and the stress of the inequality, so much fear, the constant fear. So the adrenaline just exhausts them. They just get wiped out sooner than other people of other nations in the developed world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see it in the culture as well. You know, we just saw that film Enemy of the State recently, Will Smith. And, of course, a continuation of a film done in the, I think it goes back to the 60s, called The Conversation with Gene Hackman. And talking about kind of an invasive state destroying the fabric of society. And if you go back to films to see what America used to be like, I think you'd go, a good example of America in the 50s would be American Graffiti, which is a George Lucas film with Richard Dreyfuss and some other names that have gone on, like...
Mickey Rourke.
Not Mickey Rourke, but...
Ron Howard.
Ron Howard was in it. And, of course, the star of Star... William Ford. Harrison Ford is also in American Graffiti. So, and, of course, this is George Lucas pre-Star Wars days. But it captures this innocence of a post-war America where Detroit was to be the manufacturing capital of the world. The highest per capita of anyone in America was in Detroit. The American car, of course, California celebrated the car. American Graffiti was all about the car. This was the freedom, the open road. They had the interstate highway system built by General Eisenhower, who was the president at the time. And this was, I think, probably... And then within a few short years, you had, the, of course, the lunar landing in 1969. But that was the... you know, that was... contrast American Graffiti, which is a document, really, a cultural artifact of America at that time in the West and California, with the American of Enemy of the State, the America of Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, you know, what Glenn Greenwald is revealing, the Detroit becoming America's Gaza. I mean, it's just within less than 50 or 60 years, the country has gone from this utopian vision of the open road and two girls for every guy, Beach Boys, classic song, to a pitiful open-air prison run by fascists and retrograde banking scum. It's pretty remarkable downfall in such a short period of time. I'll give it that. America does things right. When they collapse right.
Well, I mean, in the 70s in America, I recall as a child, very much like, say, France, where it's very laissez-faire in France, that people leave you alone. They don't, like, try to govern every single aspect of your personal life. So I think it's like the society around you. It's what the people want. So in the 70s, the young Americans were yet to become yuppies. They were about to become yuppies. And once they became yuppies, they were all obsessed over anybody, like, having a barbecue on the beach because, you know, they didn't want any hassle or property values declining or anything like that. So everything became about a nagging and everybody hating each other and trying to govern each other's relationships and personal lives. So it's also like the population itself is so narcissistic and so self-obsessed that they want federal legislation to prevent their neighbors from upsetting them in any way.
Mm. Well, plus in the 70s, you had a remarkable shift in culture as well, because the 70s, you know, they carried forward what was going on in the 60s, the summer of love, free love, the openness, women's rights, civil rights, black rights, minority rights, which ran smack dab into an extraordinary, really unforeseen catastrophe, and that was AIDS. You know, remember AIDS, the so-called gay plague, hit the culture centers of America in New York and L.A. with a voracity that was shocking. And this reignited a certain puritanicalism in America that hadn't been seen, you know, since Lawrence Welk days, since, you know, a couple of generations. People became hardened in their religious views. And this set up, I think, in a lot of ways, the rise of the vindictive Republican, woman-hating, you know, women rights-hating, right-wing ideologue in a lot of ways. And the momentum of that is still carried forward today. So you still have in the U.S. this incredible hatred of ever the progress that was made in the 60s by this generation who vilifies the 60s as somehow the root of all evil in America. I think that a lot of that has to do with you talk about the fear. There was a lot of fear and panic during the 70s, during the AIDS crisis, because it was quite frightening, because people were dying, many, many people dying from a hideous disease. And I think I don't think you can underestimate how much of a change in psyche that happened. And I think we still live with the effects.
So bankruptcy is in the works. Of course, so one thing I was learning is that municipalities declare Chapter 9 bankruptcy because their assets can't be liquidated. Not yet. Chapter 11, your assets might be liquidated.
Well, Chapter 7 and Chapter 11. So yeah. Chapter 11 is you're allowed to work out a deal, essentially, and you don't lose the assets. You cease operations, and then you have to try to do what you can. You're protected in a bankruptcy court. The creditors can't come in and just start liquidating willy-nilly. Chapter 7 is where the creditors immediately move in and take stuff. Chapter 9, I wasn't even aware of a Chapter 9. I guess you're saying it's for municipalities?
Chapter 9 is for municipalities, and it retains their sovereignty. This is an important point, because you can't break the 10th Amendment, at least not yet, which declare, you know, gives them sovereignty over their own matters, and you can't start liquidating like town hall and things like that and selling it off. So nobody knows it, because the scale of this bankruptcy is so huge, and you've got two basically parties in this with cash. Well, one with cash, and that's the pension funds, and the other with debt owed to them, and that's the bondholders. So those are the two parties that have to give. One of them has to give, one of them will lose, but both sides claim to have sacrosanct contracts. So some sacrosanctness is going to have to go out the window.
Well, it opens up an interesting question, because, okay, they have a $20 billion bill that they have to pay, that they're defaulting on. Now, we know from the past 5 years that anytime any major bank with large deposits, they have a $20 billion shortfall in accounts, they can go to the Federal Reserve Bank in America in Washington, D.C., open up a credit line, and they can borrow $20 billion at one percent, and they have the option to turn around and deposit that $20 billion back with the Fed and make 2%. They can make 1% spread on money that they borrowed if they so choose, Or they could lend it out. Of course, none of them are, which is one of the reasons why Detroit's going into bankruptcy. Now, so here you have a group of bankers who have that credit window, no questions asked, collateralized by deposits. Here you have Detroit, which has $20 billion deficits on the ongoing operation, but they have these pension accounts in their, on their balance sheet that are worth many, many times the liabilities that we're talking about here. So the question is, why can't they go to the Federal Reserve Bank, open up a credit line, and borrow money at 1%? Why? Why is that? Because of what I've said many, many times before, interest rate apartheid. If you're, you know, the white guy in this equation, that is to say Goldman Sachs banker, you can borrow money at 1%. If you're a black guy in this equation, like you live in Detroit, you got to go to the payday lender. You got to go pay 16, 18, 20, 25% or default. That's discrimination. You're being using interest rates as a discriminatory tool, as surely as you would put one group of people in a ghetto in South Africa or in some other country. This is discrimination. Again, it's completely against the law under the, if you look at it as a discriminatory act, once again, another law being trampled upon.
Yeah, and I saw in the New York Times article on this, somebody in the comment section noted, well, you know, looking in from the outside, this person lived in Australia, you know, isn't this a, it looks like for the U.S., the problem is healthcare, medical costs, because this is also with the firemen, policemen, and municipal workers. It's not just a pension, it's their medical costs. So the healthcare plans are what go up 10% a year, right, for the last decade. So those costs have gone crazy since we've given, basically since the rest of the economy lost any power over the fire sector. 10 years ago, post 9/11, everything has just like, there are no restrictions on the fire economy, the finance, insurance, and real estate. That's everything. So the prices on all of those, finance, insurance, and real estate, have escalated double digits every year. And if companies and municipalities and workers have to pay all these huge medical costs that mostly go to the insurance companies, you know, that's another stupid idea.
Right. Well, I guess to understand why this all happens, you know, I use the Hollywood model. So in Hollywood, the producer gets paid based on the size of the budget. So if you have a movie that costs $100 million or $200 million or $300 million, and you get paid on the size of the budget, you don't get paid on whether or not the movie makes any money. That's not an important part of your fee as a producer. It's not the key part. The key part is percentage of budget as fee. So here you have bankers who know that if they can put Detroit, if they can double or triple the amount of debt indebtedness that Detroit is suffering, they get paid on that percentage of the debt that they create. So if they, if this $20 billion becomes $200 billion, that's a tenfold increase in the fees that the bankers will charge. Who ultimately picks up the tab? Well, Detroit could slip into a situation where it becomes like Mexico. It just becomes a narco state of gangs and drug runners, in which case martial law will have to be declared, and of course everyone else is going to have to pay the price. So now, I don't understand is why people believe that the dollar is immune from all this. I mean, the only way the dollar can be immune from all this is if the federal government decides to they go from 50 American states to 49 American states, and they say that state is now out of the United States. We've got nothing to do with it. We're just going to put a guard around that state. And if anyone tries to cross over, you know, we'll shoot them. But we got nothing to do with that state. It's nothing to do with the United States. So therefore, the dollar is safe and sound. If that's not the plan, then I don't see how you can not get to the point where you figure that this is not positive for the dollar. I don't. But people believe it's not a negative.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's similar to the situation of Greece as well, or Portugal, what's happening on a state or citywide basis across the U.S. But compared to Greece or Ireland or Portugal, you see that austerity measures can be introduced there because there are cutbacks to be made on healthcare or childcare or meals, free meals, things like that. Detroit has nothing. Like, people don't have, there are no services. In fact, over half of the lights, the street lights in the city, don't actually work. They don't have any copper in it. They've already been stripped of the copper wiring. Mm-hmm. So there are no services to cut back on, and it's impossible to raise taxes because people either don't work or they can't afford to pay even their property taxes. Now, 53% of the population doesn't pay their property tax because they're unable to. So they can't increase it on the 47% who do pay, because more of them will slip off the wagon of being able to even afford it. So this is an interesting look of what's going to happen in the U.S., because there are no austerity measures that can be applied to the U.S., because there are no services. There are no public services. The only public service is the war. All your taxes go to wars and the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, it is similar to Greece. You know, of course, Greece is part of the Eurozone, which has Germany, and Germany is the most successful exporter in the world today. They've eclipsed China. So it's the most powerful, successful economy in the world today is Germany. Then you have Greece, which is a failing part of the Eurozone, and Germany is not going to let that infect the core operations of the German economy to any great degree. In the U.S., there is no Germany. There is no powerhouse. You have some couple of companies that do well, maybe in California. But other than that, I mean, you had the auto industry in Detroit, for example. They just got bailed out by the federal government. And the federal government is going to have to bail out the entire state again. And they do that by printing more money. They're not going to, in other words, that's my point. They're not going to just let Detroit and the state of Michigan secede from the union. They're going to print money. And that's a dollar negative. I don't see how anyone else can come up with any other conclusion, but many do. And the dollar is still not trading today at all-time lows. It's within, let's say, 10% of trading within all-time lows, but it's still not trading at all-time lows, as I would have thought it would be. But there's, you know, I think that I would not be buying the dollars.
Well, all of these stories segue quite well into a big story happening in the UK this week, and that is the NHS Blood Bank has been sold off to Michiganite Mitt Romney's firm, Bain Capital. He was formerly the CEO. He's no longer there, but he does collect income from them. Now, this is, again, that whole model. So when Detroit goes bankrupt, everybody's like, oh, it's because they're violent, it's because they're black, it's because it's a ghetto, and all of this stuff. And very few of the articles, you have to look really hard to find about the banking deals that bankrupted the pensions, right? The same thing with the NHS here. Now, we did a film called Public Finance, no, Private Finance or Public Swindle. And that was 5 years ago we made that. And now you're starting to see some of the predictions come true, because what was happening was, so you saw that 14 hospitals have above average death rates. So they're under investigation. Now, not once when Channel 4 did a whole profile on one of the hospitals, not once did they mention that that particular hospital was a PFI deal. The whole region is basically bankrupted by these PFI deals where they're for some reason, well, I know why it happened, but so basically the government gets to take, say it's £10 billion, that gets to take that off their books. Even though the taxpayer still owes the money, they get to take it off the book and act like it's on a private balance sheet somewhere. But the costs double, triple, quadruple compared to just running the NHS. So most people don't understand that the staffing problems, why there's so few staff, is a lot to do with the interest payments to the bankers behind the PFI deals.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the healthcare, the NHS, and other pieces of the state in the UK, like transportation, education, they, over the past 20 years, have been open to incursion by private corporations who present solutions in the form of, well, let's put that on our books, and we'll take a small fee, and the government's debt will be reduced. So just transfer the debt from the government to us. And in return, we'll manage this piece of the business that you don't particularly want to manage anyway. It's not doing much on for you guys. And then, of course, the debt, the way it's constructed, and we saw this in Greece. We've seen it in Detroit. We see it in Jefferson County in America, the J.P. Morgan scandal. We see it in private corporations across the U.K. They're now suing banks for credit default swap manipulation and extortion. The debt metastasizes. Which I can never pronounce that word. Metastasizes. How do you say that?
You said it right. Metastasizes.
Oh, metastasizes. And it grows to the point where then the government has a new problem, that they have more debt than they thought that they were making a solution. The private companies and the banks will say, well, you know, who would have ever predicted that interest rates would have done what they did or the markets did what they did? And certainly not us, even though, of course, they engineered the collapse in many ways. And so they come back with a new solution. They'll say, well, give us more of that business. And you'll say, we'll take care of that. And don't keep it on your books. We'll keep it on our books. And so this is repeated again and again for 20 years until now you have a state in the UK now where they're selling off huge pieces of profitable business like their blood bank business to private capital like Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's old firm. So they're selling the cow to buy the milk eventually. They're selling other income-producing assets, whether it's transportation, education, or healthcare, to private equity, private enterprise. They will then load it up with 10, 20, 30 times those revenues in debt and constantly seek bailouts and force the government to turn around and impose austerity measures to pay the interest on the debt.
Yeah, so... How, you know, the Tories and the new labor before them could say, oh, we're not privatizing the NHS. Don't worry, that's sacrosanct as well. We'll always have the National Health Service. What they do, of course, is through the PFI deals is we're just because the private sector can construct the building so much more efficiently. Never once have, of all the dozens and dozens and dozens of PFI projects on hospitals, bridges, and schools, none of them have actually delivered less than what the government does. Because, of course, the borrowing costs. The government can always borrow less than the private sector, always. And, of course, they also, very few, you know, public servants collect £20 million salaries or bonuses, whereas that's perfectly acceptable in the private sector with the taxpayer money. So that's how they were able, that's how they're able to privatize it, basically allow bankers in, hollow out the system, and then when it collapses, everybody points at, it's just like they do in Detroit, it's the workers. Mm-hmm. It's the workers who did this to us because they're the last ones standing. So the last fabric of the NHS standing is going to be, it's them. It's the free healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have one right now in the UK, this new rail line,
H2. Yeah,
HS2. This is their new train, high-speed train, mm-hmm. going up north. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think they've revised the budget upwards, I think, 3 times already. Now suddenly some people are starting to figure out that this is a huge boondoggle. And, of course, the debate gets screwed up because the debate is not whether or not having a train system connecting London with the north is a good idea or not. But that's what people on Newsnight or BBC tend to focus on. Is this a good idea? Do we really need a train? No, that's not the question, is it? The question is, do you want to hand over to the same charlatans that have destroyed huge swaths of the UK economy yet another free bonus in cookbooks, excessive fees, malfeasance, other criminal enterprises? That's the question that should be asked. But that question is not asked because David Cameron will deny it, and then the news will say, well, the Prime Minister denied it, and that's our investigation is now over. So that's as far as they go.
You know, the other ironic thing, of course, about Detroit is it was the power of Detroit when it was such a powerful, it was the center of wealth in America, that they managed to basically forever cripple and make dependent cities and populations across America. Like Los Angeles, for example, used to have a public, you know, tram system. Mm-hmm. They ripped that out and put in these, you know, god-awful freeways, highways all across the city in which you sit for hours in traffic jams. To get anywhere, you have to have a car, a depreciating asset, and you have to have insurance, part of the fire sector.
Yeah, those tram lines were ripped up due to the wishes of a consortium of Firestone Tire, General Motors Cars, and Exxon Motor Oil. They got together and lobbied the government to rip out the tram lines and put in highways. But, you know, in this country, we saw something which was kind of funny this past week, a rare slip, which the veil was momentarily dropped. You know, Cameron was asked about the lobbying scandal where he's in bed with tobacco companies and booze companies for obviously some underhanded malfeasance. And his response was, well, I don't entertain lobbyists the way you're describing it. I mean, sure, Tony Blair comes in here and he lobbies me all the time for his Middle East initiatives, but that's just the way things are done. So this was a rare reveal because immediately Tony Blair's PR group sprung into action and was saying, there's no way you can compare what Tony Blair does in the Middle East with tobacco and booze companies lobbying the government for free money. But, of course, you absolutely can make the comparison between Tony Blair and a tobacco company and a booze company lobbying the government for free money because, as we know from many of the documentaries that have been made, Tony Blood for Oil Blair is muckraking, barnstorming around the Mideast, cutting deals on behalf of oil companies and his sponsors in a way that is pure crony capitalism and is nothing but lobbying governments for yet more cash to support yet another Conant Square flat for Tony Blair and Cherie. But it was amusing because it did for a moment. You saw for a second that Cameron, he's not a complete dunce. He apparently did spend a few days at Eton not under the influence of some mind-altering drug.
Well, you're talking about Linton Crosby, who is the policy advisor to David Cameron. He's also works for Big Tobacco, and he's a lobbyist for tobacco. And David Cameron's very careful over and over. No matter what the question is, he answers, Linton Crosby has not lobbied me. So if he's, however, sitting in the room writing the actual legislation, David Cameron doesn't have a choice. He's not being lobbied to alter his words or what the policy will be. This guy just wrote it and handed it to him. That's not lobbying. That's writing the policy. So he keeps on saying, I haven't been lobbied. I haven't been lobbied. I have not been lobbied.
Right. It's classic sophistry and despicable behavior by the prime minister. And at least on Channel 4, from what I've seen here, the Jon Snow's show, at least they're, you know, keeping at it and going after him on this point. And the prime minister continues to be exasperated. I mean, the other comparison that I don't really, you know, find logical is that the Tories will say, you know, we're lobbied by tobacco and booze. But, you know, the labor is lobbied by organized labor, you know. And so there's an equivalency there. But I don't think there's an equivalency there. I mean, you can't equate booze and cigarettes with jobs. I mean, labor is being lobbied by the unions who are representing people who work, and those people who work make the money that makes the economy go. So without any kind of representation, the economy would go into the skids immediately. Now, you're equating that with booze and tobacco. If people stopped drinking booze and stopped smoking tobacco, the GDP would go up. If people stopped working, the GDP would crash. You can't make that equivalency. It's very trite for the prime minister to say, a boozing, pre-cancer emphysema patient is the same as somebody trying to get a better job for their family. It shows a certain Tory mindset, I think.
Well, I mean, also workers pay their taxes. International corporations do not. So we know this. And by the way, you know, this new thing really of just the booze zones, war zones, the booze war zones of all cities every Thursday and Friday night, where, you know, the police, the ambulances, they all start parking, getting ready at 6 or 7 at night. They have to erect all these, you know, urinals, because men otherwise will just pee all over the streets. But it is like a war operation. It's like a military operation to witness this, the setup of getting ready for the people to come stumbling out, vomiting and drunk and punching each other.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's certainly in the UK, isn't it? I mean, we were just in Sheffield for a couple of days, and apparently in whether Sheffield or Birmingham or...
Newcastle.
Manchester. Yeah, Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, you have just hordes of people drinking themselves to near, to unconscious levels, near death. And, but, you know, it reminds me of a statistic I heard last week, which is that the government spends on infrastructure projects in London, on average, £2,000 per capita, per head, per person. The government spends £2,000 on infrastructure for transportation, education, health, public services. How much do they spend up north? £5. £5 per capita up north versus £2,000. So, you know, this government has castigated that entire region to an early grave.
Well, however, I wonder how much is it due to, remember, the EU pours money into infrastructure. Like, they built that whole tram system, which is really nice in Sheffield. That's from EU funds. That's not from UK taxpayer. Well, some of it obviously comes back. The UK taxpayer sends money to Brussels, who sends it back in these infrastructure projects. And that's supposed to be to, you know, Ireland also received a lot of those EU funds, and Portugal and Spain. So when they first entered the Eurozone, when it first started, because in order to equalize the infrastructure across Europe. So because of these deprived areas up north, they received a lot of funding from the EU for building these. I think Liverpool also received some sort of tram system from Europe.
Well, they also have been, they've got a Culture Center Award annual thing, right? So Liverpool, wasn't that the culture center of some of UK, was it, or the Europe? Yeah. And they got a big boost.
Yeah,
they got a big boost, and so that was nice. And but on balance,
well, you could tell because Liverpool got a whole bunch of yuppie hotels and boutique hotels and B&Bs and yuppie restaurants because of that whole EU thing. I think they've now, like, it's moved on to somewhere else, but the funds do pour in from Europe during that time.
Mm. That reminds me of that show that they used to have here called Restoration. Remember that show? They go, this guy, this comedian dude, he used to be big, I guess, travels around to piles of bricks located in towns I never heard of and decides whether or not to throw money at it by getting people on the telephone to call up and crowdfund it. Mm-hmm. And he's accompanied by two prats, one fellow with a name that sounds like it came from 500 years ago, Ptolemy, and some hot scientist-looking chick.
Yeah, who is that comedian guy? Griff Rhys-Jones.
Yeah, Griff Rhys-Jones. Yeah, yeah, he's very, I love that show, Restoration. You know, I say, wow, look at that. Look at that castle. It's totally screwed up. What are they going to put a new roof on it? I'm voting for that. You know, and the people are happy in the town of Shepherdshire Shumdom. They go to this local thing, and it's got a new roof. They replaced the thatch roof that they built in 1420 with some copper roof that gets stolen the next week by thieves. They're looking to cash it in because they can't afford a pint of some triple X-rated 80-proof gut rot.
I want to start a crowdfunding site to reseize your castle from the English who have...
Yeah, they stole my castle, Caberlock Castle up there in Scotland. That's my freaking castle. That's the Maxwell clan. I'm declaring myself the new head of the Maxwell clan, as you listeners of this show know. I haven't received word yet from the Tartan people. They're storing my tartan and my emblem And I suppose I get a hat or something. And we're going to, once we get that organized, we're going to storm down to London and we're going to probably occupy a pasty shop.
It's actually really cool. If you look it up, it's a triangle castle. And that's Max's family was driven out of it.
I've noticed watching and living here in the UK this time now for almost a year and watching a lot of local television. I noticed something that any show that shows a beaten up neighborhood with council estates and drunk people and drug addicts and down and out losers, you always see in that shot a Greggs.
Yes, that's true. And actually, when we were in Sheffield, Max went to a Greggs bakery.
I went to a Greggs, and I see what it is. It's for a pound 35p, you get a sausage roll, basically. So it's like sausage rolls, and then I got an espresso there, but it was scary because it had all these tubes that were coming out of the machine with milk, but it looked like some kind of robot from some planet that had been long abandoned in this Greg's pie shop. And I had to run out of there. I couldn't take it. You know, I'm sorry to be this way, but anyway, now I see it everywhere. Wherever I go, I see Greg's. And the logo of Greg's says it all. It's got to be the least interesting logo of any company, any brand, any restaurant in the world. I believe it's four kind of creamy orange squares arranged in a square. I believe it's the logo for Greg's. And then, of course, the font on the logo is also equally uninteresting. The color is like a bleached out, uninteresting blue. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm missing something with the Greg. I prefer the Cornwell Pasty Shop.
Max Kaiser says Cornwell. Corn.
I'd go to the Cornwall Pasty Shop. That's where I get my pasties, okay? Because it's from Cornwall. The people in Cornwall know pasties. Not freaking Greg's. You're not going to Greg's. You get nothing at Greg's. What are you going to get there? Nothing. You can't get it at the Cornwall Pasty Shop. That's not made from real Cornwallians.
Well, Max, in the last few minutes, I want to read a review from Stewie Rhino, who visited Carvalhaut Castle in Scotland, where we'll one day reclaim it. You know, it gets on Google Reviews 4.8 out of 5 stars as an attraction worth going to. But this is very...
Put the thumbs down, I'll have them murdered.
Well, this is a very... No, it's got... This is good because Stewie Rhino says, a good day out for anyone who is interested in history, wildlife, mycology. Mycology? I don't know what that is. Mycology. I'm sure it's like, sounds like warts or something. Fungus. Check out the ancient graffiti in the ruins. The castle woods contain amazing fungi. Oh, and the wood itself is an excellent natural woodland. Wear good footwear as it can get boggy, and go equipped with camera and binoculars. Also keep an eye open towards the estuary for ospreys after March.
Wow, the guy likes his trees. Although I can't imagine the trees there being, you know, so spectacular that you need to blog about it. Well, this tree was a spectacular woody quality to it, and the boggy, soft grounds around my trainers gave me the impression that I was in a woods next to a stack of bricks. And so I had to blog about it. And there's some mushrooms about as well. Wow, that's so unique. There's only about 47 million spots exactly like that within a 5-mile radius. I'm having a great time. Oh boy, I hope. But I think they missed the point. This is the seat of the Maxwell Empire. That needs to be reclaimed. Why didn't they mention that? That's the point of it. It's not about the trees, you freaking moron. It's about this is my castle, and I'm reclaiming it. I'm going to write about that.
Well, maybe if you go up there and sit in the woods and talk and try to get every tourist walking past, hey, you want to join my army to reclaim my castle? They could talk about you as a feature, a wacky, eccentric feature of
Not many people know that I know how to play the bagpipes. So once I start playing Oh Danny Boy on my bagpipes, the millions will come flocking from all over the Isles. They'll come and join my march on the city of London, where we plan to restore justice and spread our tartan about.
Well, I think we've Max has just reached the end of the line here.
How dare you say that? I'm still reeling from the comments you made about men peeing everywhere. It's not as if women aren't all over the street peeing on the grass. You see it all the time. Why pick on men? You know that I was squatting down peeing everywhere. I see it all the time, and especially in Birmingham. They're known for their peeing women.
You are such a liar. Okay, well, that's it for this Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM in London, which is probably hotter than Miami today. So that's why Max was confused at the opening of the show, thinking we were in Florida.
Okay, thanks for that clarity. That's BBC compliant now. And everything we said was based on an actual citation from an out-of-print encyclopedia referring to an 18th century monk's work who's been since discredited, but nevertheless is considered to be the de facto last word. Bye, y'all.